You ready? Let's pray. Father, once again, we are grateful for another day of life, another day of health. And I thank you for giving that to us, and thank you for giving us both the privilege and the grace to bring honor to your name. We are so very grateful. And help us tonight as we take a look at creation. In your Son's name we pray. Amen. Okay, creation. It's an integral part of theological studies. But let me start with a question. Why is it important? I have some thoughts, but I want to hear yours first. Why is the doctrine of creation important?
I think it's one of the questions that all religions have to answer. Like, how do we get here?
How do we get here?
Well, okay. If your religion can't answer that question, then it's not much of a religion.
Mm-hmm.
Not knowing where we come from, yeah. Why we're here.
Okay. What else? All the ancients had creation stories, by the way. Everyone. One of the things we're going to talk about tonight briefly is how the Judeo-Christian story of creation is different from all the other creation stories. Because it's very different in some key respects. So why is it important today? So let's assume it answers the question of where we came from, how we got here. But why else?
Tells us a little bit about God also, that he existed before, that he had a plan for what he was going to do, and that he has the power to do it.
So it reveals something about God. Yeah. Why did God create?
Because it's in his nature to create things.
Okay.
Why do we create things?
Why do we?
It pleases us.
Because we made the image of God, right? Right. Keep going. Why did he create?
Because it pleases him. Every time I fabricate or make something of my own.
Well, that's the motivation. For what purpose did he create?
To do work?
What purpose? To make himself happy, right?
That's
what you're saying.
But he was already happy.
Can't he be more happy?
No. I've been asked that question by non-believers when I start talking about God. I often don't start with Jesus. I often start with creation. And one of the first questions that is, why did he do this? Why did he make it? And aside from his pleasure, for what purpose? So let's get into that. We'll talk about it. Christians today, they tend to focus on the when and the how of creation. So we have a lot of debating. We have a lot of discussion on origins. There is a debate that is slowly going away over whether it's... shouldn't say it's going away. Perhaps it's moving to the side. Short earth, young earth, old earth, six-day little creation, all of that. That was very big a couple of decades ago, but today it's not an argument that or a discussion you really see in most among most theologians in today's world, because we focus on when and how did it happen, but we have no evidence that the ancients ever even thought that way. They didn't even have that in their minds when you look at the creation order. The doctrine of creation, this is why I think it's important, is at the very heart, the core of the gospel. It's the heart and soul. The storyline of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation is from creation to new creation. And so the new creation is the ultimate goal of the Bible. The Bible ends with the new Jerusalem and the new heavens and the new earth descending. The new heavens coming down, the new Jerusalem coming down to the earth. When we get to the eternal state, at the end of the class, we'll talk more about that, because a question that is very relevant is, and a bunch of scholars have asked it, where does the Bible say you die and go to heaven? That's a Christian construct, theological construct that has been developed. Heaven in Scripture is always pictured as coming to us. Even in the picture in Revelation 21 and 22, it's coming to us. So Jesus, for example, says, blessed are the meek, they shall inherit the earth. And so heaven, simply put, is God's domain. Earth is our domain. And in the eternal state, the line between those is eradicated. And heaven comes, the new heavens join the newly created earth, and we live together. And God is present with us in the form of his son, Jesus, who is standing in the temple. And so we're going to come back and take a look at that, because the language of dying and going to heaven is one of the key factors that is causing your generation, the younger generation, to slowly move away from the faith because of it doesn't make sense to them. My last class I taught at Colorado Christian University, 40 freshmen, I asked them, how many of you are looking forward to heaven? Not one hand went up. And these are all Christian kids because they didn't understand it. They have been taught that heaven is really one eternal church service. And the Bible gives us a whole different picture. The new earth is we live on the earth. That's what we're made for. So the storyline of the Bible, creation runs right through the center of it, and it's the ultimate goal of the gospel. The new creation was launched with the resurrection of Jesus. He is said to be the first fruits of the new creation. Galatians tells us if anyone is in Christ, he is part of the new creation. So as we turn to Christ, we become part of that new creation as well. And we become a picture to the world of what this new creation, a glimpse of what it looks like. So the gospel story, the good news, is located within the context of creation. That's one of the reasons why it's important. The storyline of the Bible runs right through creation, all the way from creation to new creation. All of the creation narratives in the ancient world consistently did not hold a high view of their gods. They did not. The storyline is basically the same, although the god names of the gods change and some of the circumstances change. But the basic storyline is you have an assembly of gods, you have male and female gods, and the only way to understand them is to understand us. So they're gendered gods, they're male and female, because we're gendered gods. They have competition, they don't get along, because we have competition, we don't get along. They fight, we fight, okay? They have sexual relations, we have sexual relations, so they spawn other gods. In fact, the Canaanites believe that when it rained, they saw plants grow, and they knew that when they had sex with their wives, they got pregnant. So they developed the notion that water, the rain, was actually semen from the male gods having sexual relations with the female gods. And that's why now we use kind of sterile language to describe it. Their infertility rites is what we call them. But what that means is they believe the male gods are pursuing the female gods. And the thunder was the chariots racing around the heaven as the male gods were chasing the female gods. So they said, okay, well then how do we get the gods to have sex? Because if we can get to engage in sexual relationships, then our crops are going to grow. So they developed all of these practices in what we call the high places. And why did they think that? Because of us, as humans. There's a correspondence between nature, deity, and creation, okay, or humanity. There's a correspondence. So what is happening in one is happening in the others. If you see the mountains and they're powerful, that represents gods who are powerful. If I'm male and female, the gods are male and female. So there's a correspondence between the three of them. That's one of the key factors all of the ancient religions and the modern-day religions have, by the way. And the story of the Bible could not be more different. You have nature and you have humanity. And God is not part of that. God is completely outside of that realm. And so the Bible, from the very beginning, begins to break that pattern that the gods are not in objects, they're not in creation, they're not part of creation. God is completely distinct from creation. And the Bible is the only ancient book that teaches that. So they thought, well, because they all believe this correspondence between these three realms. And so what gets a guy excited? A woman that doesn't have clothes on. So therefore, they would go to the highest places they could in the mountains, and they would engage in sexual frolicking, orgies, and things like that to get the gods excited. That was the whole reason for doing it. So now when you read Chronicles and Kings, you read of the gods, the kings who destroyed the high places. Were the good kings, and the ones who didn't were the evil kings? That was a consistent pattern. What they're doing is they're tearing down the Canaanite worship areas high in the mountains, which the Israelites adopted. See how that correspondence works? So if we get the gods excited, male gods are going to chase female gods, and they're going to have sex, it's going to rain, crops are going to grow, and life will be good. And they had a very low view of the gods. Gods were not to be emulated. Gods were to be appeased. Very different from our worldview today. Christianity was different in every area in the creation story. The story of creation is the story of the work of the one true living God. In all the other religions, creation came about out of conflict. Gods would fight. You'd have the older God and the younger God, and the younger God would challenge the older God, would defeat and kill him, and his remains is what became the world as we know it. That's a standard viewpoint in the ancient world. And our Bible teaches us, no, God made it because he chose to make it. He's completely outside of, independent, and not related to creation. And so he made it purely because he enjoys it. He made it because he wants us to enjoy it. He made it because he wants it to reveal his glory to us. He made it because he gives us a place to work. Lots of reasons, and we'll talk about some of those. So the creation story in the Bible is the story of bringing order out of chaos. So the ancients, their primary definition of creation was not the start of something. That's not how they conceived of it. It was the formation of material already existing and bringing order to it. And we actually see that in our own creation story. So we do like to have good debates, and I love good debates. Genesis 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. We assume that means out of nothing, what we call creation ex nihilo. But that's not true, because God said in verse 27, I think it is, let me get 27, so God created humanity in his own image. He didn't make humanity out of nothing. He used the dirt. He used the existing materials to create the man and then the woman. Okay? So the word creation itself does not require that it be out of nothing. The reason why I believe it was created out of nothing is because of Hebrews 11. By faith, we believe God created the universe out of nothing. It's pretty clear in Hebrews 11. But the ancients didn't have Hebrews 11. So they weren't asking the question of beginnings.
Is there a reason that the writer of Hebrews would have made that statement, meaning why they would have believed that everything was created out of nothing?
Yeah, because it probably developed, and because, as is consistent, the Bible would allow for that in later usage. Another example of that would be, we think of God in our world today, as we talked about this last week, as Father, right? Fatherhood of God. When you hear that, that's a very personal term to you, right? But that wasn't a personal term in the ancient world. Most children didn't know their fathers. Fathers had many wives, and therefore many families. Fathers were all fighting wars, raising crops, raising animals. Fatherhood was a term of identity, not a term of relationality. So you think of how Abraham uses our father Abraham. We identify with Abraham. Okay, but the term itself allows, in later history, the development of personal relationship, which we have today. So I would say he doesn't tell us why, but we do know that from the way the creation story compares to the other creation stories, the emphasis was not on, and they weren't asking the question of when and how it happened. They were asking a different question that had more to do with who did it and why. Why did he do it? Okay. So one of the prevailing thoughts in worldview at this time was that the gods created. What that meant to them was, to us it means he makes something out of nothing. to them, it means he formulates something out of existing material, but that's not what's important. What's important is the gods are bringing order to our world. So the gods were to be appeased because their primary job was to keep order, create order, purpose, and function. So therefore, if the gods are happy, that's what they're going to do. We don't want them fighting. We want them having sex. That's what we want them doing. And so in Egypt, for example, the sun god Ra created every 24 hours. It was a 24-hour cycle for creation in the Egyptian. And that's important because the Israelites came out of Egypt. And so they brought with them several traits from Egyptian mythology. The sun god Ra would rise in the morning, and everything was ordered. Ooh, good. Trees are still growing. We're still alive. Gravity's holding us on the earth, that kind of stuff. Okay, then it would descend into the netherworld. Everything went to chaos. Comes up in the morning, there's order again. So you see no battles occurring at nighttime. They didn't fight battles at nighttime. That was the realm of chaos. They were any place where they could not see created fear. So the Israelites never had a navy, for example, because you couldn't see. They were frightened of the waters, the oceans. That was a place of chaos. They brought that with them in their worldview out of Egypt. So all the way through the Bible, you have the metaphor of darkness and light appearing side by side, God representing light, darkness representing evil, and that's how they thought, and he's communicating to them in their language. Now today, we don't associate those things together. Now, a lot of sin occurs at nighttime, but a lot of sin occurs in the daylight too. And so we don't walk around frightened of the dark. But even still, you have a little bit of that thread still running 2,000 years later, you know, being afraid of the dark, monsters in the dark, right, under your bed. It has deep roots in the history of world cosmology. And they brought that with them right out of Egypt. So their job was to make the gods happy so the gods would create order and purpose with everything. So a lot of work has been done in the last few years from very good Christian Old Testament scholars to show that the story of creation is first and foremost the story of bringing purpose to all the aspects of creation. The 6 days give us all the major spheres of creation to show that God, he himself did it and made it happen. It wasn't the product of turmoil, tension, conflict, battle, war. It's a conflict of God saying, nope. And that's how they would have interpreted it. Does it allow for later interpretation along the lines of science? I think so. I think it would. But what I'm trying to show is that the Israelites would not have heard that language. They would have not heard those questions being asked. So it's very intriguing that when God brings them out of Egypt, they're just a group of slaves. That's all they are. They don't know anything about government policy, military strategy, foreign and domestic policy, supply and demand. That was all handled by the Egyptians. They were simply slaves. They had one job, make bricks. That's what you do. We'll even give you the straw to do it. So they didn't know how to get that. So they didn't have the basic elements needed, knowledge needed to run a nation. So they weren't really a nation. They were a group of ragtag slaves. That's what they were. That's why the story of Moses is so critical, because God, if God had not routed Moses into the basket to be raised in Pharaoh's court, then there would have been no nation. He was the one with the knowledge. So therefore, the Pharaoh's declaration to kill all the baby children, males, is one of those places in the Bible where redemptive history runs right up to the cliff. And if God doesn't intervene, there'd be no Jesus. There'd be no Israel, no nation, no Jesus. So God intervened on behalf of one of the Israelite males to get him routed into the Pharaoh's court. Redemptive history is protected. Up is raised a national leader, a very good leader. He would have been trained in all of the languages, arts, sciences, everything, along with Pharaoh's children. And so he was equipped to lead a nation and form a nation. So when he gets out to Sinai, and they're finally standing there, the Egyptian army's been defeated. So now they're standing there at the base of Mount Sinai. What's the first thing God tells them? Ten Commandments. These are the basic 10 things that every culture needs to survive. You shouldn't murder. You shouldn't steal your neighbor's wives and cattle and all that sort of stuff. You should worship only one God. When any of those 10 commandments begin to fail, then culture begins to fail. So the 10 commandments were a priceless gift to the world of what it takes to make society function in a smooth manner, where you care for each other, you put each other first, that sort of thing. The second thing he gave them, those came on 10 tablets, two tablets of stone. The second piece of information he gave them was a creation story. Let me tell you the truth about everything you see. Don't believe what you just were raised with in Egypt. So the creation story is at the heart of redemption, because the very redemption is God. He's stepping into an area that is messy or broken and repairing it. So giving the creation story is an example of redemption, because their history was faulty, it was flawed. And he said, let me tell you the truth about all that happened. And so that's why the creation story is right at the beginning of the Bible. Because the very first thing to do in creating identity, and identity is necessary for solidarity, to form a nation, the very first thing he does, he said, here are the 10 basic principles that you need to survive together. Now I'm going to begin to tell you the stories of what happened. Here's the creation story. Now you all have a common identity, and it's different from everyone else in the world. Does that make sense? It's what we do similarly in church. What do with our young children? We tell them the story of Jonah and the big fish. Their school friends don't know that story. We tell them the story of Gideon or the burning bush. You remember the story. You remember them. They're not old enough to understand why those stories are important and how they fit into the plan of God, redemptive history. Every one of those stories plays a pivotal role in God unveiling the gospel to the world. But they don't know that. But what they do know is their identity is now being formed, and because they know stories that are different from what their friends know. So their Christian friends all know the same stories. They know about Jesus and the cross, Jonah and the big fish, right? The burning bush. And it's not until much later, at your age, and I would even argue that many of you haven't been through it, where you go through the process of connecting the dots on all of those stories and saying, why are they theologically significant? So it's interesting that the very first thing God chose to tell them was creation. Let me tell you the truth. Because creation relates to the one true God. Their cosmology, that's the name of it, that's the term for understanding how the world is, their cosmology was Egyptian. And God had to shift that in order to create an identity of his own people. You follow me so far? Okay. So it's placed right at the beginning. It is the story of bringing order out of chaos. That's what the primary message of creation is. God is in control. It represents God's control of chaos in the ordering of creation. It's not simply a story about forming the world. They weren't interested in that. It was important to understand how powerful our God was. And to say that our God made all of this begins to give us a glimpse of how powerful he is. So the creation story represents God's control of chaos. So this immediately raises a divine or theological point that begins to permeate our heritage. And it's this: nature is not divine. In every other religion, nature is divine. And so right off the bat, when God tells the story, they realize God is not part of nature. So therefore, nature is not divine. That's breaking that ancient correspondence right off the bat between the divine and the creation. They're not the same. They're not the same. Humanity and nature, you can put them together side by side, okay, however you want to frame it, but God is not part of that. God is completely other and distinct from that. So when he tells them the creation story, that's the first theological point that begins to surface. That God is distinctly different from them. Creation comes from the one true living God. So now, when you see the Gospels being presented and the argument occurring all throughout the New Testament, they start with the creation. I'll give you some examples of that. We typically start with the individual. Do you know Jesus? Right? Then, once we've secured that you know Jesus, now we say, are you part of a church? Okay? We may get to creation somewhere down the road, years down the road, when, oh, by the way, you need to take a class like this when we talk about creation. Well, look at what Paul does in Colossians 1. In fact, this is his pattern everywhere you go. He reverses the pattern. Whenever he is talking about, in fact, let's start in Acts 14. Whenever he is talking about creation and about this God, this is his sermon in Lystra. He starts with creation. So in Acts 14, he's in Lystra. And so when the apostles, Barnabas and Paul, heard this, see, the people of Lystra, they thought that they were Zeus and Hermes, and so they start worshiping them. And they both go, no, they ripped their clothes, don't look, we're men like you, don't worship us. So when they heard this, Barnabas and Paul, they tore their clothes, rushed out into the crowd shouting, friends, why are you doing this? We too are only humans like you. We are bringing you the good news, telling you to turn from these worthless idols to the living God who made the heavens and the earth. There it is. So the very beginning of the story of the gospel in verse 15 is creation. Turn to the living God who made the heavens and the earth and the sea and everything in them. Then he begins to move out into culture and the impact of sin in the world. But that's where he starts. If you move a little bit further over in Acts 17, here he is at the Athenian Areopagus, arguing with the philosophers in Athens. In verse 13, let's see here, probably verse 16 is what I really mean to say. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day where those happened to be there. A group of Epicurean Stoic philosophers began to debate with him. Some of them asked, what is this babbler trying to say? Others remarked, he seems to be advocating foreign gods. See, in the ancient world, the gods that you worshipped had to be recognized by the federal government, the Roman government. You had to be registered. Your religion had to be registered. He's talking about a god that they don't know anything about. Can't do that. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then he took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus where they said to him, may we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting? You're bringing some strange ideas to our ears. Paul stood up, verse 22, in the Areopagus, it said, people of Athens, I see that you are religious in every way. For as I walked around, I see the God, the altar to an unknown God. This is what I'm going to proclaim to you, verse 23. Verse 24, here's his message. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth. Starts with creation. See it? Go over to Colossians, a very famous, probably, I believe it is, ancient hymn that Paul may or may not have written, but he certainly co-opted it, in Colossians 1, 15. Listen to the order. It's the opposite of what we do when we present Christ. Verse 15, the Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and on him all things hold together. Now he moves from there to the church. And he is the head of the body of the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn among the dead, so that in everything he might have supremacy. For God is pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him. He moves from the church to Jesus, and through him to reconcile to himself all things. Verse 21, once you were alienated, now it gets to the individual. Once you were alienated from God and were enemies, but now he has reconciled you by Christ. So when Paul shares the gospel, he starts with creation. He doesn't start with the cross. That's foreign to us in our world. Because creation is the rock. It's the foundation of belief in the one true God. Some of you have heard the story. I've been talking to a 24-year-old, and he came to me from another state, got out of federal prison, committed a felony, and he was kind of discouraged, and somebody gave him my number. He called up and said that you would be willing to talk to me. I said, yeah, so we started spending time together. And he asked me, my counselor in jail said I should figure out what I think about God. Can you believe it? Does anybody believe in God these days? And I said, well, I do. You do? And he said, yeah. And he goes, well, could this be the result of karma, what happened to me? I said, well, if there was a God, let's just assume for a moment there was, would you want that God to believe in karma? And this young man said, no, absolutely not. My God doesn't believe in karma. And he goes, huh. Oh. Well, how do I find this God? I said, what do I have to do? And I said, absolutely nothing. He'll find you. He will? Yeah. And he goes, cool. So I said, but if you want to spend time together, I know him. And I can introduce him to you. And he said, I'd really like that. It's our first meeting, Red Buffalo Coffee in Silverthorne. Tell me something about this God. And I said, everything out there, he made it. And he turns his chair around, stares out the window for 2 minutes. I just had to drink my coffee and let him stare. He looked at the mountains, just looked at it for 2 minutes. And he turned his chair back around and said, why? Why did he make this? And I said, two reasons. One is, I gave him the two simple reasons, so that you would enjoy it. Do you enjoy creation? He said, very much. I love snowboarding and hiking and all that. Good. Then you're automatically one step closer to God because you're doing what he wanted you to do. The second reason is because it reveals something about him. It's one of his ways of teaching you how great he is. And he goes, huh. Turn back around and just stare at the mountains. Creation shouts the glory of God, Psalm 19. Let it tell its story. So all the authors begin with creation as the introduction to the gospel. So we typically go, we start with the individual. Do you know Jesus? We move from there to the church. Are you in church? And then we may get to creation. They reverse that. Let's start with creation and help you get a glimpse of how transcendent, how big this God is. Capture your attention. And then begin to move backwards toward your relationship with him. It's a very effective way to share and have a conversation about God. The story of the gospel is only understandable as part of the story of creation. Because the Bible lays it out. You have creation, fall, redemption, the hope of restoration, new creation. And that order is how the Bible lays out what God did. And so we get to the ultimate hope, a new creation of which we are part of. The only way the world has to see a glimpse of this new creation, their only way is to look at us. There's no other way. Because the rest of creation hasn't been redeemed yet. That's why Romans 8 said it's groaning in travail, waiting for us to get our act together. That's my words. We are the first fruits as part of the redemptive process. And so the rest of creation follows along after we are finished, after we're redeemed. That's why we're called first fruits. And so the only way the broken world out there can have a glimpse of the new creation is to look at us. And therefore, the only way to have hope is to believe in a restoration process, a new creation, to have true hope. So that's why right off the beginning, the very beginning of the story, our lives matter, because the world is broken, and we represent to the world what it looks like to be part of the new order. So we should not act like the world. They're complaining, we shouldn't complain. They're abusing each other, we should not do that. We should be the first ones to run and help people. My son, who's 36, came to know the Lord last year. A big tornado came through eastern Texas, eastern Dallas, went right around his house. That convinced him that the Lord just protected he and his family. He didn't know where to turn to. He called me to tell me about what happened to the tornado. And everything in me is tempted to tell him about Jesus on the cross, but he grew up in a Christian family. He already knows the stories. And I just said, well, how do you process that? What does that mean? He says, I think God might just have saved my family. He said, I think he might have. And he said, I'm not sure what to do now. I said, you'll figure it out. Don't worry. I've told you all along, God will find you. You'll know what to do. Along comes a church. He called me like minutes after the earthquake, the tornado. Along comes a local church and says, we have food. Let us feed you. Let us take care of your family. Let us get you into a hotel. They just guided them through the process. Guess where he's going to church? right there. He caught a glimpse of the new creation, because the world doesn't do that. His friends didn't do it. And so we are the ones that represent the new creation to the world, because we're part of it. This is why Christianity has consistently affirmed God's role in creation. It's at the beginning of the Apostle Creed. We believe in God the Father. What comes next? Creator of heaven and earth. Right? Justin Martyr, 165 AD. We worship the God of the Christians, whom we consider one from the beginning, the creator and maker of all creation. Irenaeus, 190. The church believes in one God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, the sea and all the things that are in them. The Nicene Creed, AD 325. These are the beginning of the creeds. We believe in one God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth and of all things visible and invisible. The Constantinople Creed, AD 381. We believe in one God, the Father of all, governing creator of heaven and earth, of all things visible and invisible. The Westminster Confession, 1646. It pleased God the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost for the manifestation of the glory of his eternal power, wisdom, and goodness in the beginning to create or make of nothing the world and all things there, invisible or invisible. All the creeds affirm that nothing in creation is self-existent or eternal. Everything owes its existence to God as creator, and therefore, every one of the creeds begins with the creation story. If you're interested, I have a book in there of the creeds. You can read them. And they all start the same way. How does our doctrinal statement read? We believe in one God, the sovereign creator. That's how the sentence begins. So it's just worth thinking about. Don't downplay the role of creation in helping someone grasp who God is. This is why it's important to study. I've said for many, many years, if you're having trouble discussing Jesus with your friends, take them for a hike. Let God do it. The heavens shout the glory of God, Psalm 19. Take them for a hike. Sit on a rock, have a sandwich with him, and ask him, what do you see? What do you see? Let God tell a story. When I was in Germany as a missionary, I quickly noticed that people who came to our ministry who were either new Christians or not Christians, they had a real vibrancy about them as they entered into their faith, because they knew what they were saved from. The Christians who came to my ministry for a while, I didn't know what to do with them. I almost hated it when Christians came, raised in a Christian family, because they were very low on their zeal, had very little energy for the Lord. You know, they'd rather be out drinking, doing what the world's doing. They didn't have a sense of what they had been saved from. So I began to wrestle with all this, and I thought, all right, then we need to do two things. We need to give them a bigger picture of who God is, and we need to get them into a place where they can vicariously experience sin. I don't want them to go through and become a drug addict, but I want them to see what a drug addict's life is like. So I began taking them out one at a time, in the summer especially. We go lay in a field. We just stare at the sky, and I'd say, what do you see? Looking at the stars. Great. What else do you see? A lot of stars. A lot of stars. And it would take almost all of them at least 45 minutes to get to the point where they'd finally say, God's pretty big, isn't he? Yeah, it kind of looks that way, doesn't it? We're not very big when you look at all creation. That was that first step toward recapturing a vision. The next thing we'd do is we'd go down to the park, and we were in Germany, so we'd go down to the park and where the drug addicts hung out, and then we would feed them in the soup line. We'd go to an AIDS hospice center where they're dying, and we'd bathe AIDS patients who are just like a week or two away from dying. And they began to see what they had managed to avoid by God's grace, and you saw their zeal start to grow. So all the stories in the Bible didn't help them grow. And so, but capturing the canopy of stars, that's why there's so much in this wonderful book about that. It gives you a picture of how big God really is. So if you're having trouble, you don't know how to talk to your friends about Jesus, or you don't know the words, or they're not really in agreement with you, don't fight with them. Let God tell the story. Take them out for a hike. Ask them what they see. Do that regularly. Let God tell the story. So our statement of faith is we believe in one God, the sovereign creator. Creation is very important in the story because it is the picture of who God is in our world today. He's very big. In fact, if you find your own faith either in crisis or doubt or your own faith waning and you're kind of blasé in your faith, then you go for a hike. Go with a friend and just stare at the mountains and look and say, what do I learn? Just a thought. Second question, why did God create? You've already said some of it itself. I mean, some of it earlier. I would say, number one, he created to reveal himself. I have a couple of quotes here from really good theologians. God created freely that which was not God, and among his reasons for creating was a desire to see his creation freely reflect his glory and bask in his love. He wanted to reveal himself, like an artist reveals himself in music or a painting or whatever, you know? Your children reveal themselves when they make something, a drawing, they come and show it to you. I've noticed, it's like when I first got here, the 9, 10, 11-year-old girls all started bringing me drawings. I have all drawer full of them, a file full of them. Then they all grew into teenagers. The drawings stopped. Now they give me hugs. I'm not complaining. In the last 3 Sundays, 2 young girls have brought me drawings. Ah, the next crop. One of them says, you are very nice. I have no idea what the picture is, but it's pretty. So I take these and I go put them back and I start my second crop of, they're revealing themselves in their artwork. And they're proud of it. And they're so excited to see what I'm going to do with it. So I almost always get down on my knees and say, this is fantastic. Can I give you a hug? You know, I have a drawer of drawings from my people that, girls that, can I put yours in there? Yeah. You know, they're excited. They reveal themselves. And so God created to reveal himself. Romans 1:20 is an interesting passage. We like to argue from Romans 1 because of all the language around sexual orientation, but it's really smart to pay attention to the rest of the language around it. Since the creation of the world, this is Romans 1:20, see where Paul starts? Before he gets into the whole lengthy discussion on sin for 2.5 chapters, he starts with creation. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made. Creation has a powerful testimony. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made.
Why does it say divine nature? Because earlier you mentioned nature is not divine.
Yeah, but we're talking about God's divine nature. We're not talking about nature in a sense of woods and trees. We're talking about God's nature himself. So his divine nature is revealed through creation, through nature. Okay? Because he's an artist. And he wants to reveal himself. And so he gave lots of ways to reveal himself to us. Creation is one of them, but it's a very powerful one. It's one that we neglect today. We enjoy it like when we're in the amphitheater, when we're out hiking. But to think of it as a tool to help someone come to know Christ, we don't think that way at all. Right? I have a friend that, not a Christian. We became friends. He loves to sail. And so we've been sailing many times this past summer. Nancy and I bought a sailboat. He's a better sailor than I am, has a bigger boat. So we take turns on each other's boats. The two of us go out and we just talk. What do you see out there? What do you like about creation? It's so interesting as it's softening him over time, you know, wanting to open up. So we had lunch yesterday together. And he said to me, he said, you're the first Christian that isn't putting pressure on me. There's no expectations. You just want to be with me, don't you? I said, I do. I just love being with you. We've become really good friends. And all of a sudden now he's opening up and telling me his family story. But it's taken me 8 months. And spending all that time, 75 hours we spent out on the water, softening that crust that the world's created. Because it's his language. He speaks it. Don't underestimate the power of creation. It shouts the glory of God. So the first reason God created is to reveal himself. The second one is to lead us to worship him as the one true living God. That's the second reason he created. It draws us to himself. I mean, Paul says right here that it gives us enough information about God, but there's more than that. If you look in Psalm 24, we're going to look at several little passages here. Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. And then all of a sudden, he says he founded it on the seas and established it on the waters. And then all of a sudden he makes a move into worship. Who may ascend the mountain of the Lord? Who may stand in his holy place? The one who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not trust in an idol or swear by a false god. So in the context, what is the idol in the false god? Or better yet, who's the true God? The one who created the earth. And so he's connecting worship, entering into God's presence with a belief in the one true God that he made all this. Now, this would have been powerful in the ancient world where they were pantheistic, polytheistic, and henotheistic. God was in everything, part of everything, mixed up with all the other gods. Okay? And so he's saying, the earth is the Lord's, Yahweh's, his alone. And so the one who can enter into the presence of God is the one who believes this. But what we know about this one true God is he made everything. So worship is tied to creation right there. Psalm 19, another one that I just quoted, you heard it. The heavens declare or shout the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them, yet their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the end of the world. In the heavens, God has pitched a tent for the sun. It is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, like a champion racing to run his course. It rises from one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is deprived of its warmth. Now, this right here is defeating the part of the Egyptian cosmology that the God every 24 hours. He's showing that the creation is subject to him, not the other way around, with this language. This is part of worship. Listen to creation. Its voice, even though it has no speech, goes from end to end in creation, everywhere you go. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece of artwork. Let's see, Revelation 4:11, if we go to the end of the story. Let's see, Revelation 4:11. In Revelation 4, we're standing in the throne room of God, and John in Revelation 4 was whisked up to heaven, and he's getting a chance to see world events through God's eyes. That's the story of Revelation. And here's how chapter 4 concludes. You are worthy, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things. By your will they were created and they have their being. So worship is directly tied to creation here as well. And there's many other places. I'm just giving you a couple of samples. So we don't worship the creation. We worship the God of the creation, but creation reveals the God of the creation. And so creation should be a very thriving, vital part of our worship experience. Often on Sunday mornings, if you notice me, I'm up front. Sometimes I have my hands raised. Sometimes I just stand there singing. Sometimes I'm looking around smiling at the kids. But I always look out the window. I always stop and look out the window while we're singing just to recalibrate before I get up there to preach. I'm about to represent the God who made all of that. That's what my thinking is every Sunday. I'm about to represent him. And I pray almost every time before I walk up there, God, whatever bumbling words I use, no matter how intelligent or unintelligent, you figure out how to use them so that the people only hear what you want them to hear.
Intelligent.
Huh?
Intelligent.
Yeah, that's right. So, and I almost always glance out at creation just to recalibrate and say, I'm going to represent the God who made that. That mountain that I'm looking at. So God created us to worship him. He created to lead us to worship him as the one true God. Another reason God created, it was to give us a mission. Right from the beginning, we are given a mission. When you ask the average Christian, why did God create you? For what purpose? They almost always say, to glorify Him and worship Him. Think carefully about this. I want to get married and have 4 kids so that they'll worship me. That sounds odd. It sounds uncomfortable, doesn't it? What the Bible says is, let us make humans in our image. Genesis 1:26, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea. Okay? The way to bring glory to God is to live the life that He created you to live. So my children, I raise them to be wise children. And when they start living a life of faith, that glorifies me. So glory is the byproduct of living a life of faith. The purpose for which He created us was to work. That doesn't change. When you look carefully at the Revelation 21:22 story, there's indicators that that mission is still a very thriving, vital part of the new earth. You have, for example, the picture of the gates are open 24 hours a day. Why were the gates closed at nighttime on a walled city?
Chaos. Keep out all the chaos.
Protection. They wanted to be safe. Close and lock the gates, had guards watching to make sure nobody could sneak in. So if the gates are open 24 hours a day, that's a statement about safety. It's a statement about order. But then it says the nations and the kings are coming and going in and out of the New Jerusalem, bringing their glory to the Lord, to Jesus, the Lamb. Okay? That's, they're bringing their things that they've made, their wares, their products. They're still busy working. And that's what we're created for. That was our created purpose. My own personal theory is that all of creation is there for us to explore. We have all of eternity to explore. I'm too old to be an astronaut, but it won't be too late. I'm going to get to see other planets. And all of creation is meant for us to explore, play in, work, and learn about God. So those little details are woven throughout the text in Revelation 21 and 22. But the very beginning of the story, right from the beginning, God said, let us make human beings in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over creation. So being made in God's image both enables and entitles us to exercise dominion well. We have a responsibility to do that. Furthermore, we are to serve creation. Genesis 2:15. Now, I want to distinguish this. It doesn't say we're to worship creation. Genesis 2:15. The Lord took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. The word to work there is a fairly unique word in Hebrew that has the idea of serving. Okay, taking care of it. That's the second thing he says. And we serve creation. Why do we serve creation? Let me just ask you. Why serve creation?
Because
God made it. Okay. Why else? Keep going. Okay, but why do we care if it's destroyed or not? Why do we not want it to be destroyed?
It's cool.
It's cool. It's awesome. It's glorious and beautiful. What else?
That's where we live.
Could we survive without it?
No.
No. We have a mutually dependent relationship. The earth needs us to take care of it, and we need the earth to live.
The earth needs us to take care of it. Why?
Because it just goes to chaos ultimately. Okay, which is the picture of the garden. So God, the picture in Genesis, God created a garden out of chaos. Okay, and He said, "You're to take care of it." So anything you see in nature, it just goes back to chaos, and that's not what God created the creation for. Keep that in mind.
I don't think that the current earth is what God created it for either. So the question is, are we doing a better or worse job of taking care of the earth over a certain period of time than chaos would otherwise do?
Depends on where you are on the earth. I mean, I think we have the best environmental policies in the world. In fact, my theory is that we should kick all the environmentalists out of our country and tell them not to come back until the other countries look like ours. Right? But even still, but we are making something beautiful out of creation, which is what we're designed to do. My friend at Seminary, Don Payne, asked the question, is God pleased with a bridge that's beautiful and safe? I think so. That's creation. We created a bridge. Ask a civil engineer. That's their painting, that bridge. Are cars beautiful? They are. They get more and more beautiful. So we think in creation in terms of artwork and music, but it's really in everything we do, the way we tell our gardens, the way we build our houses. So you can look at, you can go into an adult shop, a porn shop, and you can see evidence of God's glory. Because no animals can do that. We're the only part of creation that could turn this creativity into such a mess. But you can still see evidence of God's glory there. Because no animals could do it. Nothing else in creation could do what they did. So I would say, yeah. But it goes back to, what is the purpose of creation? Not to be chaotic.
And what's your definition of beauty?
Yeah. Right. And all,
I mean, gets, skyscraper is different.
All gets wrapped in there, doesn't it?
It's beautiful in a different way than a rainforest.
Yeah. Right. That's right. So as we care for the earth, we are performing the very function that God created us for, bringing order and caring for it, protecting it. So it's just worth thinking about. That's what we're created for. That's how we glorify God, is by living our lives in ways that to honor Him. Just like your children. When your children live responsible lives, you get the glory. You know? People say to me, man, you got great kids. And that just makes me feel wonderful. And so that's how God is glorified. Okay, why renew the creation? Why not just start over? Any thoughts on that? Why not just start over?
Because redemption is as big a part of who God is as creation is.
Yeah. It's really amazing to think a little more deeply. We'll get to this when we get to anthropology, but that Paul argues that God is culpable in our sin. Paul said, how would I have known, Romans 8, that it was sin if he had not said, given us the commandment? So what energized sin or brought it into the world was God saying, don't eat of that tree. So God has some responsibility in our decision to sin. Mark and I agree on this, that sin was as much a part of God's plan as redemption all along the way. He knew full well when he gave us a choice, that's what's going to happen. Because sin lives in tension with grace. And as we're going to be arguing every Sunday from the pulpit, that honestly, sin is what leads us to understand grace. It's one of those tensions. I had a six-year-old after the service on Sunday, a mother, gave me a quote from a six-year-old. I think sin is necessary because it forces us to talk to God. That is a theologian. And so sin is a part of God's creation. And he knew that the moment he said, don't eat that tree. We did. And so sin becomes wrapped up. And so redemption is part of his nature to redeem things. And so that's what renewing the creation is. I put a myth in your handout. The earth, this is a myth. The earth is not some temporary shelter for humanity to be discarded once it is worn out. Rather, in spite of its bondage to decay, it remains God's glorious handiwork. So when we think, and the church was guilty of this for quite some time throughout its history, that it doesn't matter what we do to the earth because we're going to a new earth, going to heaven. That's really bad theology. Because this is our home right here. That's why Christ said, the meek shall inherit the earth. The original creation, although marred by sin, is still very good. Genesis 1:31 said it was very good, and then sin. But then after that, all these passages, Psalm 19, the heavens shout the glory of God. Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. Isaiah 40, all of creation is under his control. 1 Timothy 4, everything God created is good. So the earth is still good. It's still good. It's still very good. It's just got an issue that needs to be redeemed. And yet, because of sin, a full renovation is required. And that's the gospel story. That's the argument of the Bible. The expectation of renewed creation is bound up together with the messianic hope. Isaiah 11, when the Messiah returns, the earth will be returned to the peace found in Eden. That's the prophecy in Isaiah 11. Isaiah 65 and 66, when the Messiah returns, all of creation will be restored as well. Has it happened right now? No. But it's happened to me. Do I have my glorified body? No. But am I part of the renewed creation? You bet. And the world can look at me when I live my life faithfully, and they can see a glimpse of the new creation. Therefore, they can have hope. Because I can do what they can't truly do. I can actually forgive and love and do all those things. As I move toward the image of Christ, that's the technical language, be transformed into the image of Christ. Christ is the image of, he is the true human. Image of God, he is a true human. As I'm transformed into his image, I become more and more human. That's something that differentiates from the other religions. I don't become something different. Because we fundamentally believe I have dignity, and you have dignity because we're made in the image of God. So I've asked a question on many occasions. You're standing there and you're looking out at a field of snow, and it's just beautiful, pristine snow, and you see the sparkling from the sun, the rays, the icicles hanging. Nobody's walked across it yet. You know what I'm talking about, right? We live in that part of the world. And then all of a sudden you hear a retching sound, and you look down and you see a drunk down here, an alcoholic, rustling, and his eyes are rolled back. He hasn't bathed in weeks, probably, stoned up all over himself. Where do you see God the clearest? Creation is not made in the image of God. That's how much dignity we have. So imagine if the world can see God more clearly in humanity. Imagine how powerful the message is when they see us being transformed into true humans, what we were created to be all along. We are the most loving, forgiving, gracious, kind, hardworking people the world has ever seen. And the world doesn't know how to do that. We're not grumbling and complaining. We're not fighting about politics. We're not doing that. We're out there serving. We're looking for opportunities to reflect the new creation to a world that desperately wants it. Just a thought. It goes against our natural thinking, doesn't it? Could see God more clearly by looking at the worst sinner. So we believe as Christianity, this is one of the hard core theologies that we are made. We have dignity. That's where dignity came from, is Christian belief, because we believe you're made in the image of God. You don't have to become something else through reincarnation. You don't have to empty yourself and become nothing and reach nirvana. You're not a light source that's going to be emitted in New Age philosophy and get absorbed by a bigger light force. No, source, no. You are made in the image of God, and you have dignity. Of that. And you are worth serving no matter how vile you are. That's why Christ gets to the point where he says, turn the other cheek. Paul says, do good to those who hate you. Love your enemies, Jesus says. It's because every human has dignity. And so we show the world by our actions this new creation. And then they begin to wonder, how do you get there? How'd you do that? So new creation is important. So it's very good, and all the Bible passages as they unfold reveal that, and it also reveals that a renovation is required. The renewal of all creation begins with Jesus. By resurrecting the crucified Jesus, God has reaffirmed that he still likes his creation, and it's very good. So he has no intention of destroying it. It's interesting when you read the passage, often misunderstood in 1 Peter 2, about the heavens burning up and everything melting away. If you read it carefully, what it says is the earth is never discussed in the being done away with. He burns away the planets and the stars. He melts away the creation outside of earth, but earth itself remains intact. And it says he does that and lays it bare so that he can rebuild it. So our earth is not going away. This is our home. There's no place that says the earth is destroyed that I know of in the Bible. This is our home.
What's new about the new earth?
Sin is dealt with.
Meaning the curse no longer exists? The
curse no longer exists. And along with the curse come all of the trappings of the curse. Everything from sin with us to pollution in the world, those are all redone, refashioned. That's why I'm going to argue just a minute that care of creation should be a core part of our theology. Christianity is the one that brought about care of creation.
The earth is similarly populated.
Well, what do you mean by that? I think so. But I should ask you.
I mean, cities are going to have, cities will have millions of people. There will be rural areas that will have fewer.
I think so.
Move around.
He made the nations. And in all through Revelation, all the nations still exist. We retain our ethnic identity. I tell my Nepalese friends, when I get to the New Earth, I'm going to spend a lot of time over in your part of the woods because I love the way you design. Your architecture is very different than my architecture. I think it's fabulous. I want to go over and hang out. I love going to Kathmandu. It's very different. So, yeah, I think so. I think ethnic groups are part of God's eternal plan on purpose. So I have no problem with. By the way, the New Jerusalem is not an actual city. You know that, right? The New Jerusalem is the people of God. It's a metaphor. He describes that. I see the New Jerusalem coming out of heaven, the people of God. So the New Jerusalem is a metaphor for the people of God that are being restored to the earth once it's been renewed, remodeled, renovated, if you will. Yeah, we'll come back to that. So the creation is not some accident. It's not some divine mistake. Creation is the very heart, the very core of what God is doing to produce creatures, us, who remain in his image and who worship him for eternity. The earth remains God's glorious handiwork. By resurrecting the crucified Jesus, God has begun the process of renewing creation. So we get a glimpse by looking at Jesus as the human of what's coming. Then we get a further glimpse by looking at Christians of what God is doing. That's why Paul can claim in Ephesians 3, to God be the glory in the church. There's not some banner on an airplane. There's no billboard with flashing lights. Here's God's glory. We are the ones that reflect his glory. John Calvin said, we are a mirror. We reflect the glory of the Lord. And so as we work really hard to live our lives of faith, we reflect the glory of God to the rest of creation. And you get a glimpse. The new creation, because we're part of it now. Galatians, we're part of that new creation. So, what are the implications of the Christian doctrine of creation? The last question. In other words, what difference does it make? Here are my thoughts. Number one is it eliminates several other models for understanding how creation relates to the divine realm. So you have the model of deism. God made it and walked away and doesn't have anything to do with it. Many of our founding fathers actually were deists. It's up to us to do it. God's not actively engaged with us in that. The Christian view is that because of God's providence and covenantal promises, he is intimately concerned with and involved in the creation. He doesn't leave it alone. Another model, pantheism, that God is the universe or that he inhabits the universe. The Christian view is that God is distinct from the universe and not part of it. This is why the creation story and the doctrine of creation is so critical. A third model, henotheism. God is a supreme God among a pantheon of gods, which is very similar to polytheism, which is many gods, without one necessarily being higher than the others. The Christian view is that there's only one God, and there's none other. God exposes henotheism, polytheism, and paganism throughout the Old Testament, and reveals it as a sham. So all of these ancient religions that held to one form or another, the creation story in the Bible, it eliminates all those models as not a possibility. That's what it does. That's how unique our story is. That's why God starts in the beginning. Before he explains who he is, he explains what he made. And then automatically they begin to say, well, then what we learned about the sun god Ra, is it true? Exactly. Second reason that the implications is that it makes a distinction between God and creation. And we are already losing that in our culture today. We're merging the lines between caring for creation and worshiping creation. There are there's groups now in Canada that are we started out with this saying, I don't identify with being a male. I really identify with being a female. That led to the whole transgender, transsexual discussion. But now we have a whole other movement. I don't identify with being a human. So now they're doing a exploratory work in Canada, surgery to put in feline parts, for example, to see if a human can give birth to a cat. I actually identify with a cat, not a human. There's a group in California that says, I don't identify with a human, I identify with the ocean. I'm at one, at peace with creation, when I'm sexually connected to the ocean. I have no idea what that means, but somebody thinks about it. And so the creation doctrine in Christianity makes a distinction between God and creation. God is separate from creation. While it is God's creation, he's not the creation. Creation owes its existence to God. And we commit ourselves to his care of creation and devotion to its final rescue. That's his model, is renovation and redemption of the earth. That should be our theology as well. I'm a big fan of recycling and anything else we can do to protect the earth, keep it safe and clean. When I was in Nepal, we talked through this just a couple weeks ago. And I said, you guys want to make a difference? You're already doing it. But be a leader in your city to clean it up. It's fascinating. On the main street, you got the church. So on the main street are all these, I got these pictures of all these little shops. Boom, 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 boom. Well, you know, they're all 10 by 10 shops. Hundreds of them in a row. They're filthy, pollution, dirty, litter, trash. And then in front of the church, there's five little places that they own that they rent out to Christians. So you walk along, there's dirt, filth, trash, and all of a sudden you have five very clean businesses and then a whole bunch of dirty ones again. The reason why I took the picture is because guess where all the Hindus were shopping? At the five. You know? They're very successful because they're clean. So I talked to them about, do more than that. That's a good start. You know, get elected to government. Start a movement to clean up your own streets. Show that Christianity cares about things. Another reason, another implication, is it creates a divide between heaven and earth, spiritual and material realities, and therefore God's authority in our lives. There are two parallel but interlocking realities which consist of the unseen and the visible. Often the material realities are visible counterpoints of the heavenly realities. That doesn't mean the correspondences. Don't mistake that with the other religions, that when we look at a tree and we see God. That's not it at all. But the material world gives us a glimpse of what's happening in the spiritual world. And so when we merge those two, we lose that picture. And we begin to worship the creation rather than the creator. Another one. It affirms the existence of the duality between good and evil and the existence of suffering and rebellion. The story of the new creation affirms our belief that God will eliminate evil through his plan of redemption. So right now they coexist, and it gives us a picture. It proves the existence of good and evil, that they both exist. As we are moving towards Christ, we're moving towards goodness. You only have two choices. Move toward Christ, or you can move away from Christ. Those are your two choices. You become more human, or you become less human. Those are the two. You're not static. Nobody's static. And so, a good doctrine of creation preserves that duality and gives evidence that it exists. By the way, that may be behind Tolkien's creation of Gollum. Because remember, Gollum was actually a good-looking man in the beginning, and he was overtaken by greed, and by the end, you don't recognize him as a human anymore. I know several British scholars in the Church of England that that's their view of what happens to humans. You become less and less human over time as you reject and rebel against God. And ultimately, you're no longer recognizable as a human. So, just a thought. So, conclusion. A good doctrine of creation places environmental concern right at the core of our theology. It's right at the heart. We should be the leaders in environmentalism. Doesn't mean we worship creation, but we should be the leaders. And sadly, for a good portion of the church, it's not that important. In fact, if anything, they distinctly shy away from it, so they're not connected with the slang terms of tree huggers and things like that. If you think about the way we disparage environmentalists, we don't want to be associated with them, so we distinctly don't do that. No, we should be partnering with them. You know? What a great opportunity to reveal the truth about a new creation. So it should be a very core doctrine. The very first time I said that up front there, I got a pretty good earful for several weeks that, are you a liberal? No. Why do you think that? Because you're mentioning environmentalism. Whoa. And no, we should be at the front and center of that movement to care for that. When I land in Nepal, when I take off from Nepal, I'll describe it this way. I have pictures. It's so polluted. The houses, the condos across the street, I have pictures where you can just see the outline. That's it. We're just across. It's not even a two-lane road. It's barely a two-lane road. And the building across the street is an outline in the pollution. I have a picture sitting at the airport. I took a picture out the window of the airplane next to me. You can just see the outline of the airplane. You can't even see down the runway. It's so polluted there. It's amazing. It's just amazing. That's the byproduct of Hinduism. Who doesn't really care about it? When you take off, it's just like coming above the clouds. As you're getting further and further away from the earth gets kind of more and more indistinct because it's getting blurrier, but you begin to see the smokestacks when you're looking down, and you can see the plumes on the ground of the soot. You know, in our country, it's against the law, federal law, to even see an emission from a smokestack. It's against the law to even see an emission. It has to be clear, odorless, colorless, and no particulates. And then all of a sudden, it's just like coming out of a cloud bank. You rise right above the pollution. Then you can see the tops of all the Himalayas. There's Everest, K2. You see them all covered with snow, beautiful as can be. But when you're down in there, you can't see it. So we should be the leaders in environmental care. Care for creation. Creation care is what how many Christian scholars think of it. We care for the creation. Okay. See what next week is. Ooh, Jesus. Sweet. Let's start talking about Jesus. Who is Jesus? Why is he God? How can he be God and man? How can he be God and human at the same time? All right, let me pray. Father, thanks. Thanks for giving us this wonderful, beautiful earth. I can tell you, Lord, that sitting around the table, we all enjoy it. Thank you for that. And thank you for giving us work to do to preserve it, care for it, serve it, take good care of it. And thank you for the reciprocity that the creation cares for us as well. Help us to enjoy it even more and to care for it. In your son's name, amen.